And the topic, we'll just say it's God. And it begins, does God exist? And here's just some different views of it and how we can go about approaching the existence of God. And those who are like myself and yourself, we'd be considered theist. We believe that God exists. And we believe that God revealed himself enough for us to know that he exists and to realize that we can seek and understand more about him. So to believe that God exists, to be a theist, you're going to have to believe that he has revealed himself. And the issue is going to be, you're going to be looking at evidence. You're going to be looking at what he has put here. And here's the things that are listed here. There's available information, there's life experiences, and there's motivation on how you're going to approach being a theist, looking at this information, or an atheist. And you're going to be looking at the same information, and both people are going to be coming to different conclusions. And again, like it says there, it's point three, you're looking at the same available information, and that's, you know, so you're, that's not going to have much difference. You're just how you're going to interpret it. But you're going to have life experiences, and you're going to have some kind of a presupposition, and that's how you approach the information on your decision. Point two, there are two atheists. I've got quotes from Dan Barker and Richard Dawkins. Dan Barker, and again, these are good atheistic statements. I disagree with them, but Dan Barker says in 1992, he says, I am an atheist because there is no evidence for the existence of God. That should be all that needs to be said about it. No evidence, no belief. So he's looking at the information, the same information a theist is looking at, and a theist says, there's enough information for me to believe in a God. The atheist looks at it and says, there's not. There's not enough information, so there's no belief. You've got to have information to have faith in it. And again, the ideal of belief, both the atheist and the true theist is talking about seeing information, placing trust, faith in what is seen. We're not talking about just believing in something that's unseeable or unknowable. We're talking about seeing some kind of evidence, some kind of information, and making a decision on it. Richard Dawkins says this, faith is the great cop-out, the great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence. Faith is belief in spite of, even perhaps because of, the lack of evidence. Now that, Richard Dawkins, I think, makes a lot of mistakes. I think philosophically he makes a lot of assumptions that are just off the radar. I mean, in that book I was referring to last week, Anthony Flew, the old school atheist who became a deist by the end of his life, says the evidence proves there is a God. And I referred to that last week. He criticizes Richard Dawkins because Richard Dawkins is what they'd call the new atheist. And they're basically, he says, they're more like, preachers. They're more fervent. They're like just trying to attack than they are logical discussions. Anthony Flew is from the old school and would have debates at Oxford in the Socrates Club with C.S. Lewis, and a large group would come together, and they would have discussions. And sometimes they'd have, sometimes C.S. Lewis would be on the defense and have to make an explanation, have to go back and rework his presentation, because Anthony Flew would make some points against what C.S. Lewis. So it was an intellectual debate. Where the Richard Dawkins, just in this statement right here, I mean, faith is the great cop-out, the great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence. That's not what Paul does. That's not what Paul tells us to do. That's not what the theist does. They're looking at the information and coming to a conclusion, so they are thinking. I would even say that Richard Dawkins and his new atheistic approach is really just the same thing, but on the other side. It's like, we're not going to think, we're just going to argue and insult, which is kind of typical for today. Point three, both theists and atheists claim evidence or lack of evidence. Both are using human reasoning to interpret the same evidence, but drawing different conclusions. The difference in interpretation result, like I said, the available information that they've got available to look at, their own life experience and their motivation, their presuppositions. So if you're an atheist, you're going to look at the information and say, well, it's not convincing. Where the theist, and I've done this, where you see a little bit of information, like, oh, look, you know, and then you got to be careful that you don't jump too quickly and make conclusions. Point four, evidence, interpretation, and absolute certainty. Those are three important points. There's evidence. Then there's going to be the interpretation of the evidence. So you're going to have this information, and both people are going to have to look at the information and interpret. Just like we look at Scripture, and you got different churches and different denominations, they're reading the same text of Scripture, but how they're interpreting it may end up going one direction or another, or actually be counter each other. And then, of course, absolute certainty. We are on, I don't want to say on thin ice, but there are certain things that we cannot be absolutely certain on. And we'll talk about that here. So you always got to be aware of this when you make a statement. Number one, there is very little in life that we can claim to be true with absolute certainty. Again, that's a fact. You think about it. You can have opinions. You can do research. You can look at the evidence. But when you make a statement, are you absolutely sure? Now, that doesn't mean absolute truth doesn't exist. It just means we are veiled. We are clouded. We are limited. We are finite. I do not see or know everything. So when I make an absolute statement, I'm making that absolute statement from a place that is absolutely not all-knowing. So, and that's everything. There are a few things that we can be absolutely certain on, and there's different levels of truth if you're talking about mathematical truth, philosophical truth, historical truth, or in this case, theological truth. Number two, even if God wrote his name in the sky, here's an example, and that appeared saying, I exist, humans would still have to interpret what they saw or what they claimed to have seen or what they remembered seeing or what they videotaped. And you, I mean, look at the news today. You can see the event. Now, some people can become masters of spin. And I think we're looking at that in our media today of like, this is what happened. And now all of a sudden they're spinning it off like this because they don't want to give credit this way. So they're spinning off a very clear event and spinning it off as negative. It's like, how can that be negative? Well, if we say it long enough. So again, there is that, what we'd call spin. But even then, if you saw some, if God wrote in the sky, I exist, someone saw it, or they claimed to have seen it, or they just remembered seeing it, it's gone. Now you've got to go back and talk about what you saw. And that's what happened with the resurrection. Jesus came out of the tomb, and the disciples saw him. They touched him. They spent 40 days with him, and they were the witnesses of this event. There was many, many people, not just the 11 or 12, but there was many people that saw, even the large group saw him, and now they became the witnesses. But as they began to go off and tell what they saw, they were questioned. They were, even today, it's like we've got, they're written, they wrote it down. And so you've got witnesses that wrote down what they saw, large groups of people that within their time frame, they could be questioned. Even Paul in 1 Corinthians, he says, there's a large group, you can go ask them. Many of them are still alive. You can go talk to them. We don't have that opportunity, but the Corinthians could have found, I know they did, they could have met some of the people that saw Jesus at his resurrection, after his resurrection. But yet, again, now we're into interpretation, and what are you going to do with this information? So what we're saying here about God writing his name in the sky applies to that also. It goes on and says, this does not mean there are many truths, I said that. There is only one true interpretation, and others are false interpretations, but there still will not be 100% agreement or 100% certainty. This is true of historical details, current events, evaluation of a person's motive, and legal cases, all of these things. If I have court cases, they're going to have to make a decision, and they're going to have to look at the evidence and come to what is the best conclusion. Number three is important. What we're attempting when we interpret the evidence is the best explanation for the evidence that we have. When you're looking at this information or the evidence, what is the best explanation for that evidence? And for example, as a Christian, looking at Jesus' resurrection, you've got the witnesses, you've got the written documents, and putting all those things together, the best explanation is there was a resurrection. So we're looking at evidence. Evidence. All right. So that's what he's looking at this right here. Point three, what we are attempting when we interpret the evidence is the best explanation for the evidence. We do have evidence of this, for example. We do have evidence of a universe. Now again, in the postmodern age, this is apologetics is going to become more and more challenging as we move on through our culture. We're in the postmodern age. And so they can deny everything. They can deny and change their own personal truths. And they can, you know, they can deny the universe. They can say there's multiple universes. There's all kinds of things coming out there to clouds the discussion. But we are safe to say there is a universe. This is a fact. There is a universe. We live in it. You are part of it. Then, number two, scientifically, we know that universe had a beginning. So you have a universe. You have a beginning. The next thing is we have complex forms of life, DNA cells, genetics, all these things, you know, movements, complex life, the way the body works, the way the eye works. The eye is a big deal in the discussion going through evolution over the last 150 years. They used to say that the eye just kind of grew out of a nerve that was sensitive to light. But now they're looking back and they're realizing now in the new science, fighting the new atheist, that the eye is too complex to have just evolved. It had to have been designed. This is, again, evidence. We have complex beings in this universe, and we have natural moral knowledge in mankind. So we'll just say natural morals. And we talked about this the last week. So now you have, this is the evidence we have. You have a universe that had a beginning. You have complex life forms in this universe. And you have morals and a sense of morality within human nature. Different. Now, can you really say that? Yes, because humans are different than an animal. You do not have the same moral struggles with cattle that you have with humans. And again, that's universal. I mean, you may have different societies, but there's still this struggle for morals. There's still going to be some kind of court, some kind of law, some kind of rules that society's supposed to follow. You go into the animal kingdom, there may be some survival techniques, but they're not going to deal with morals. Now, with that being said, it says, number four, this is not a matter of mankind asking for a type of evidence he'd like to interpret, instead mankind interpreting the evidence that is there. It is like a crime scene. I've used this example before. This is the evidence you are looking at right there. The theist, I'm going to look at this, and I'm going to say, this is an indication there's a creator, there is a God, because this came from somewhere. It's a beginning, all these, we talked about this before. The atheist is going to look at it and he's going to say there's not enough information. There's not the right kind of information. What about this question? What about the fact that there's evil in the world? What about the fact that, and he's going to list, oh, what about all the crimes religion has done throughout history? And these are going to be, oh, what about all this? And how do you know? What about the afterlife? If there's a God, is there even an afterlife? So the atheist is going to sit over here. And it's like, in the next part of the notes, it's like going into a crime scene, and we used this example before. You come home, and all of your stuff is gone. Everything's gone. All the valuables are out of your house. So you call the police. You call the investigative team. They come in, and they go, well, you know, I don't see any, no one left a note. We see no name. No one left their name. There's no note here. It's like, but my stuff is gone. They go, well, we're looking for someone to leave a note. Well, that's the atheist looking like, why doesn't God make himself clear? Well, I think for the theist, look at this is clear. It's like you come into your house, all my stuff is gone. Someone took my stuff. Where did my stuff is gone. My neighbor didn't take it. My kids didn't take it. There was a thief came in my house apparently and took it. The investigation team says, well, we don't have no evidence. There's no name on this. And so you're looking at the same evidence, but you're stretching for what you're looking for. Number five, atheists are not off the hook because they want additional evidence. See, this is just because you can ask questions doesn't mean this is wrong. And that atheist is not off the hook because they want a different type of evidence or a more convincing type of evidence. It says mankind needs to draw a conclusion about the existence of God from the evidence they do have, and that is Romans chapter 1, 19 and 20, right here. This is Romans 1, 19 and 20. Paul writes, "For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them, for His invisible attributes, namely His eternal power, His divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so that they are without excuse." Now that was writing in like 52 A.D. That was before we got all the details of the complexity of the creation. And that's Paul writing then. It goes on and point this, it says, point five, it says, "By using the same standards of proof we use in our everyday life, we can demonstrate God's existence." Number one, looking at this information here, proven by definition. This is important, right? Proven by definition, which is similar to solving an algebraic equation using proofs. Once it is determined that the universe came into existence, we can sort through the alternatives. This is where you are. You have this evidence. Now you've got to explain this. These alternatives can be categorized as whatever you come up with. You can list out 14 or 50 things. They're going to fall into two categories. This came into existence through a random process. Or this came about through a special creation. Now, using the mathematical probability, the option of the universe existing through a random process can be overwhelmingly eliminated. All these things right here, they just came out of nowhere. Well, that's mathematically, in this universe, using intelligence, using math, using logic, that doesn't happen. That just doesn't happen. The eye doesn't just come out of nothing. And that's just one part of creation. So the only other alternative is for some kind of special creation, or that there is some kind of a God out there. And Paul does say that these things indicate God's nature. So we don't just know that there is a God. If we press the issue, this does not just prove that there's a creator out there. It also begins to identify His nature, that He is, like Paul says, is eternal. You look at this world, and He has to be, we talked about the last week, He's got to be outside of time. And so just by looking at creation, you can begin to fill in the blank. Even before you get to special revelation of the Bible, it says there is a God, and you start looking at these things, it starts indicating some of God's very nature that you know who God is. Now the atheists say, well, there's not enough information there. It's like, well, what is your explanation for this? It's random. It just happened. That's illogical, is what this is being presented. Number two, the probabilistic proof using statistics. The laws of physics are used to predict the probability of an eclipse that happens, or the probability of sending a man to the moon, the probability of engineering a bridge that will support traffic, and the probability of engineering a car that will operate. Because we live in a universe and there's principles, there's physics, there's weights, there's math, we can put in information in and figure out what is the probability of getting this bridge built successfully, or getting to the moon and back, or when will the eclipse be? How fast are things moving? This answers here, point B, the detailed prophecies and the historical fulfillment can be used to show the probability of the Bible being divinely inspired, the same way the laws of physics are used to declare the probability of an eclipse. In other words, we're looking now not at natural revelation, but you're looking at special revelation and the fact of all these things. And someone, Josh McDowell, one of the many things he's done, is the probability of Jesus fulfilling all the prophecies. I remember the illustration. I don't have it here in my notes. I haven't read it recently. But I remember from a long time ago, was if you put, you know, silver dollars all across the Texas, I don't know, 2 feet deep or something, and threw one silver dollar out there with an X on the back of it, and then you went out there and just randomly picked one up. That is the probability of a man fulfilling all the prophecies that Jesus fulfilled. And remember, a lot of those prophecies were not, they weren't self-fulfilled. They were things that were done to Him. He couldn't create it. And then you say, well, that's just the writers of the Bible. They just made this up. again, now we get into the authenticity of the Scripture argument. But you go back and all these things were written over a long period of time, and the Dead Sea Scrolls are a huge part of the evidence because those were clearly written before the time of Christ. These things were there. Jesus was reading them, quoting them from the text of Scripture. And then they began to happen. And again, it's not just the Bible. All the Bible's just right. It's just written to make things up. You've got Jewish writing. You've got Romans writing. You've got people watching these things take place, testimonies outside of Scripture. Not to, and again, we don't just want to undermine Scripture, but you've got Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Plus, you've got Paul the Apostle, we're looking back, that are taking this special revelation and saying, this happened. This is true. So the probability cause is another factor going into that the Scriptures are accurate in this case. Legal proof, number three, to prove the truth of events that happened only one time, such as a crime, it happens one time, or a sports event, I mean, some, you know, home run to win the World Series, or life of a historical figure, Abraham Lincoln, you're going to have some kind of legal proof. How do you prove a one-time event? If it's a crime, if it's a sports event, if it's someone's life, you're going to need eyewitness testimonies, and you're going to need circumstantial evidence. And again, we've got the eyewitness testimonies, for example, of the apostles, but you also have circumstantial evidence. And here's point B. Jesus' resurrection and Jesus' claim to be God had eyewitness testimonies. You know, and I wrote the gospel accounts, but also there's secular historical documents worth looking at. I was very impressed when I got into that several years ago, started looking at all of the, if you just take the Bible out of the picture, there's, and I've talked about it before, the Jews are writing about Jesus. The Jews at that time were writing about Jesus, trying to discredit him in their own writings, handed down, giving up all, you know, talk about him doing magic and him being a deceiver. And it's like, why are they saying he was doing magic and why are they saying he was a deceiver and into trickery? Because he was doing things that was convincing people he was doing miracles. This is not the Bible saying it. It's the Jews of his day talking about he was doing magic. He was doing tricks. He was doing something to deceive the people. It's like, okay, that was their spin on it. But nonetheless, that does tell you these things. One, Jesus did exist without biblical evidence, and Jesus was doing things that amazed the people, and his enemies had to give him credit for doing tricks, magic, using deception, the sleight of hand or something, because it was deceiving the people. Now, being deceived is, again, an opinion. He was bringing people to the truth. He was bringing people, he's revealing God, but they were going away from the Judaizers, and so they were considering it as deception. Same way in politics. If you're leaning one way politically and someone's bringing your group the other direction, you're being deceived. See the truth. And so anyway, there was eyewitness testimonies, not just in the Bible, but in the writings of that time. And number two, circumstantial evidence. The conversion of Paul, the development and growth of the church, the historic response of the Jews and of the Romans. And so you have of Christ's life, you have circumstantial evidence that shows that something happened. Now, again, Paul's life is in the Scriptures and his great turnaround, but you still have the fact that the church started and it continued to grow. Just as Jesus said, there had to be something take place. That'd be an example of circumstantial evidence. Now, these are all examples of why we know there's a God and why we know there's the Bible is true in the face of an atheist who's going to have to explain everything I've just said. The atheist is going to have to counter the universe and say, well, the universe, it came out of, it random happened. Well, what about the life of Jesus? Well, someone just made that up. Well, now, it wasn't just someone. In the Bible, there's a multitude of people. And then we put the Bible aside. The Jews are trying to explain it. The Romans are responding to it. And so you've got a lot of things. I used to think that we had a problem when I was younger. I used to think we had a problem proving Jesus existed, that there was a man named Jesus. Because you get the impression sometimes, especially in the 70s, that a lot of these things when you're into an academic world, you know, like college or some class or something, that this Jesus is just a mythological figure. That they just made it up. And then as I got on into and started studying, I began to realize, and again, there were some things that I just assumed were a challenge for my faith that when I got into studying, it's like there's not a problem here. There is not a challenge. People give the impression, well, they just made Jesus up. No, you can take the scriptures and set them aside, and it is a historical fact. People accept it now. If they're honest, if they're academically honest, if they have integrity, there was a man named Jesus. Now, does that prove he was God? Well, not yet, but it does prove historically around 30 AD, there was a man named Jesus, and he left his mark in history. We haven't even talked about the scriptures. We're just talking about this as a historical fact. You not just have writings, you've got world events that responded to this. You've got archaeological evidence. You've got a lot of things proving that this took place. So for someone to say Jesus is a mythological figure, that is not academic. That is not scientific. That is, you're trying to intimidate me. You might be speaking from ignorance, maybe. But a lot of times, like when I was a young, like, in my teenage years, someone could say stuff, and I would be like, oh, well, we got this challenge. I don't know what to do with this. Jesus existed. There was a historical man named Jesus around 30 AD. Now you start putting things together, and now, to prove that he was the Son of God, to demonstrate that he was resurrected, that's another set of questions. But the fact that he existed is not, that's not even a debate. So you've got, the atheist has to deal with the fact that there is a universe with complex life, and there was a man named Jesus in 30 AD that history revolves around. What are you going to do? Well, there's not enough evidence. Okay, you don't like the evidence. You're requesting special evidence, but it is there. Here there are now arguments for the existence of God on the bottom of page 2. And now begin a list of, and again, you've heard these before, these are the arguments for God's existence. When we say arguments, we're not like, arguing, like angrily shouting or anything. But there is the classic proofs. These are arguments that use philosophical categories, and they need to be different. For these to be effective, you're going to have one coming from this angle, one coming from another angle. They can't all be the same thing. And these are what they are. They're philosophical categories and concepts found in the philosophy of the ancient Greeks and later detailed for Christian theism by Christian philosophers. There are four basic arguments. I'll write them down here very quickly. Cosmological. Teleological. And I'm just writing them down so I've got them on the board so I can point at them and draw circles around them. That's part of the effectiveness of a good teacher, is to be able to scribble on a board while you're talking. Ontological. And I hope I wrote them sloppily enough that if I misspelled them, you can't tell for sure if they're misspelled. The cosmos, these are arguments. Have you heard of these before? This can become boring or monotonous because this is standard. This is nothing like I had to, dig deep into the books or had to climb high on a mountain. This is just there. You look at apologetics, this comes up all the time. So cosmological arguments. Some of them are stronger than others. Depending on the person that's using them or listening to them, some are more effective. Some people discredit one or two of them, but you can't discredit all of them. Even as the history of apologetics has gone on for the last 2,000 years, Some of them have been discredited. But the thing is, you can't discredit all of them. Here we go. The cosmological argument. Use of existing universe as proof for the existence of God. Since there is a universe rather than not at all, the universe must have been caused by something beyond itself. This is an argument based on the law of causality. Every finite thing is caused by something other than itself. That's the principle. Every finite thing, if there's a finite thing, it was caused by something. That's a law. That's a principle. Now you've got to apply that to the universe, and you can't just keep going back further and further. There has to be the original beginning. The process of basic cosmological thinking is this right here. 10 steps if you want to stay with me. 1, something exists. It owes its existence either to nothing or to something. Nothing cannot cause something. So, point four, there is something which is either one or many. If many, the beings would be mutually dependent for their own existence or dependent on another, which would move it back another generation of where did it come from. They cannot be mutually dependent for their existence because something cannot exist through a being on which it confers existence. Therefore, there must be one being. There must be one. See, right there with that argument, there must be one being through which all other beings exist. This one being must exist through itself, meaning it can't exist connected to creation. It can't exist based on something else, otherwise that something else would be its cause. This one thing has to be the origin of the things. Whatever exists through itself exists in the highest degree of all. Therefore, a supremely perfect being exists in the highest degree. This is not Christianity. This is philosophy. This is logic. This is the laws of the way things work in this universe. So you've got this one out there. Now, two types of cosmological arguments, because the universe needs both a creating force of origin, but also a conserving force. I hope you're with me on this. If not, I apologize. We're not just talking about creation. We're talking about something that's going to now maintain the creation. And that's Hebrews talks about that, that he is holding things together by the power of his word. Not just that he created the universe was created at his word, but he's also sustaining it and maintaining it with the power of his word. And that's what comes up right here. One, the horizontal argument reasons back to the cause of the beginning of the universe. So there had to be a cause, okay? That's this perfect being that's outside. But two, the vertical argument reasons from being of the universe. This is based on the premise that something is keeping the universe in existence right now as it is. It can't just start it and then it just continues forever by itself. Whatever started it, otherwise it just started off, it's going to just go on forever and ever by itself. Something, this original cause, has to be hovering over it, maintaining it to get it to its desired place. It has to still be in the being. He's still got to be over it. And that's Colossians 1:17. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. Right there you've got your horizontal and vertical argument in Colossians 1:17. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. Horizontal, vertical. Hebrews 1:3. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature, and he upholds the universe by the word of his power. It doesn't say he creates the universe by his word. It says he upholds the universe. We know he created it by his word, but he's also upholding it by his word, and that's part of this cosmological argument. Now, interestingly, and this is amazing, we're getting into theism here, and theism is the idea that there is a God who is transcendent and immanent. Transcendent, he's outside, meaning we've talked about that before. If this is creation, God can't be in here. He's got to be outside of the creation. But immanent, that he can come into the creation. He can come in and be part of it, but he is not part of it. He can enter it in. Some people just make it very simple. It is, if God is outside, he's transcendent. If he comes inside of it, it's a miracle. He's now intervening. So some people use, when they talk about miracles, they're not just talking about, you know, someone being healed. They're talking about any time God intervenes in history, anytime he steps into his world, his creation, and does something, it's in a sense a miracle. You call it a supernatural manifestation. We just think God is intervening. But transcendent is outside, immanent on the inside. This is theism. And there are three groups, and you know this, there are three groups that are theistic. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And so Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all want to prove their theistic position using this cosmological argument. And so we now come to the Kalam theory right here. And this is from the early days of Islam. And again, it doesn't prove Islam. It proves theism. That's what Islam was trying to prove. The Kalam, that's point four there at the bottom. Kalam, cosmological argument, or the horizontal argument. Three basic points in the Kalam argument. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. Now, this goes back into the early days of Islam, where their theologians were putting this. It's Greek philosophy. And again, when Islam had a day where they inherited, they conquered the Greek world. So they inherited, they brought in, they adapted to the Greek philosophy. And it affected their thinking. And they used it in a good way. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore, the universe has a cause. Science defends the second point above because of two positions. I'm on page four now. The Big Bang Theory. Science claims the universe began in a colossal explosion a finite time ago. Thus, the universe is not eternal, and the universe is in time. Now, I don't have time to go into it right now, but the 1920s were a huge time for this. You had Hubble, however you spell Hubble, you had Einstein, and you had C.S. Lewis, all about this time taking place. And Hubble, Einstein had a theory about time. Hubble looked through the telescope and saw the theory, and Einstein was shown. It's like Hubble's saying the universe is expanding, and about that time, C.S. Lewis is looking at the Greek text as an atheist, criticizing his friends who are over in a pub in London because they are believers, and he was an atheist, and he's a scholar, and he's reading the Greek text, and he comes back and says, oh my gosh, this is true. So this right here, Lewis began a great movement to counteract the atheist in Oxford and over in London, Hubble scientifically, Einstein mathematically, and they all came to the same conclusion all at about the same time, in the same few months, that the universe had a beginning. Now, this is not unique to us, but up until that time, their science was always developing, but they had the idea that the universe was a constant. The universe, one of the presentations in the philosophical world, was, and scientifically, the universe has always existed. End discussion. There's no need for God. This has always been like this. That's it. But Hubble, Einstein, the math, and the observation with the telescope brought this together, and it rewrote history. And they came up with what they called the Big Bang Theory. It's like, in other words, it rocked science. This universe is not static. Now again, that doesn't mean anything to us because we just know that. But no one could refute it. The universe was not static. It wasn't just always here at this perpetual state. It had a beginning, and it's going from here to here, from a place of order to a place of disorder, and we're somewhere in this spectrum moving towards the end. And it revolutionized science. It revolutionized philosophy. C.S. Lewis jumped on board with his part, with his logical arguments, and that is what the Kalam theory said in the beginning. The Big Bang theory proves that we had a beginning. Number B on page four, the second law of thermodynamics: since the universe came into existence at a point of finite time, it is continuing to expand. Science says that every object in the universe is moving away from every other object. Again, if you have the point of beginning right here, and it exploded, everything is moving further away. And again, this is science. This is one of the things and I step out of my area. I was going to say out of my area of expertise, but understand, I am just reciting information. I am not an expert. But one of the things that I was watching that Genesis is history, is if that is true and things are expanding, if the universe, they said, now again, you're going to just hear me say this. I'm just repeating what I said. It makes sense to me. It can be refuted, I'm sure. Everything can be refuted. But like the rings around the planets, like the rings around Saturn, is if the universe, and we know it began at the Big Bang, boom, there it began, and things began to go away, things began to spiral away. If the universe is as old as science needs it to be, to even try to make evolution take place, and again, you can't have enough time for evolution to take place the way they want it to take place because it's impossible. But they want it to be millions and millions, billions of years old. Those rings around the planets and other objects should not be rings. They're deteriorating. As longer we talk here tonight, those rings are expanding and deteriorating. In other words, if the universe is as old as they say it is, we should not be looking able to see rings and take photographs through telescopes of the rings around the planets. Does that make sense? They should have already just been, but they're still tight enough that we, in 2019, can still look through a telescope and see those rings that are continuing to expand. But we can still look at it. It's like going back and watching the pyramids being built. Not really, but I'm saying. It's like, where are you at a time? You're close enough to the beginning that you can still see the rings coming off of the planets, which means maybe the universe is not as old as they tell us it is. And it's going to have to be confined. And there's probably some pieces scientifically we're still missing. Right now, we've got to have this astronomical large amount of time to try and make sense. But in the 1800s, they had to have a static universe for their science to make sense. And then came the 20s when it's like, wait, it began, the Big Bang, and all of a sudden all science was rewritten. Right now, we've got something as ridiculous, I think, as the static universe. We've got this billions of years stretched out, because that's the only way we can make sense of it. It's just going to take one discovery, one mathematical discovery to put this together and say, wait a minute, we can reduce this whole thing down into a much smaller amount of time, and this is the way it happened. Now, again, I don't know what that is. That's just my prediction. That's just my prediction. And I understand science having to have a billion, because that's where they're at. But someday something's going to happen and suddenly, wait, we don't need a billion years. We can do this in this amount of time. And now it's scientifically, it makes sense. We'll see what happens. Okay. And we already said this last week. It says the second law of thermodynamics says that all isolated systems will tend towards a state of maximum disorder, and the amount of usable energy is decreasing. The universe is running down, which means it had a beginning. Point 3 on page 4. The logic of the third point above in the Kellum argument says, based on the law of causality, which whatever comes into existence must have had a cause. The universe has a cause. The cause that created the matter of the universe must be immaterial. The cause that created the time in the universe must be timeless. The cause that created the space in the universe must be spaceless. If you're going to create time, you're timeless. If you're going to create space, you must be spaceless. If you're going to create material, you must be immaterial. To say something with matter, time, and space created matter, time, and space would be absurd, because the creation would have to exist before its own existence. Because the cause existed forever without the universe must exist because the cause willed it to exist. Thus, the cause has a will and is personal, meaning not personal, like, oh, what a personal person. They're very friendly. That's not what we're talking about. We're meaning they've got a mind. They can interact. They can think. They can speak. They can communicate. And they've got a will. They can determine certain things. They're not just a force. And we're not talking Star Wars. We're not just have a force. We've got a being, a personal being with a will that's making decisions. All of this together presents a cause that is immaterial, timeless, spaceless, personal, and powerful. Now on page 5, I've got a diagram I pulled off some of my notes from way back, probably 2005. This is the Kellum theory in a presentation. This is just a graphic. I think it's on my website. But I typed this up and handed it out in church many, many years ago. We begin our discussion with the understanding that the universe does exist. There's your argument. It does exist. Now, here's the questions in the Kellum theory. Here's how it goes. You answer these questions. 1, was there a beginning? No, there was no beginning. Okay, well, that's impossible since it does exist. It's impossible since everything in the universe has a beginning. If the universe is eternal, then it would have run out of energy long ago. The way science is moving, if the universe is eternal, and it's always been here, well, then why do we still have energy? Because by this time in eternity, we would no longer have energy. So it is not eternal. So the answer to was there a beginning is yes, there was a beginning. Okay, that's true. Okay, now there was a beginning. The next question is, was the universe caused? The answer would be the universe was not caused. That's impossible since everything is caused. So was the universe caused? Yes, that's the true statement. What was the cause? A random directionless force. Something, just a power out there. Impossible. Just like 1A, shaking the parts together of a watch can put a watch together. Or a tornado can build a house when it blows through a lumber yard. You know, those examples. And you remember, I told you this a long time ago. You remember the story I told you? I did this for a children's lesson with the watch. I had a wind-up clock. It had a little lid on it. What do you call it? A pocket watch. And it had all the moving parts in it. And it didn't work any longer, so I took it apart and put it in this tin can. Actually, I had it for my boys so they could play with it. But I used, it's one thing you have a children's lesson. It's one of the jobs as the pastor of the church I was at. You had to have a children's lesson. It's like not only do you have to have a message ready and be friendly, you also got to have a children's message and print a bulletin. And like one pastor told me, he says, you can wing a sermon. You can't wing a bulletin. So most of the time when I was pastor at church, I spent most of my time on Saturday getting the bulletin ready. I mean, all the announcements and all little quotes and sayings and fun things and some kind of cover. You remember that, Tony, making all those bulletins? We kept them all, too. They're like publications. It's like I still got the stack of them because it's like we spent time with them. Now, the sermon, I may not have spent any time on that. You can wing a sermon, but you got to hand out the bulletin off subject. But one of the things I had to do besides the bulletin, be friendly and all these other pastoral things, is do a children's sermon. So I grabbed this can of these watch parts, and I showed the kids the face of the clock. You can still see that. Showed them one of the hands and some of the other parts. Says, now I'm going to shake this, and we're going to make a watch. And, of course, I apologize if you heard the story. But I was sitting there, and all the church was there, and I was in the front. All the kids came up front, and the pastor, he was standing there, and I would do my thing. I shake the can, and the kids are just really excited because this is going to be a cool trick. I'm going to shake the can, and I said, well, let's see how it's doing. And I open it up, and they look in there. It's like, oh, the kids are all trying to see the watch come together. And, we need a little more time. And they're like, okay. Shaking it. And then the second time I looked at it, now this time they're not quite as excited because, like, they could still hear the parts. And I said, wait, we need to shake a little bit longer. And now the kids, by the third time, the kids are heckling me. I'm shaking. They go, no. It's like the children, we're talking 5-year-olds, 7-year-olds are like making fun. No. It's like, no, just a little more time. It's like, no, Mom, I'm done here. And their kids are just like, we've lost interest in this magic. It's not going to work. And that's the same thing. The universe came into existence. What was the cause? A random directionless force? No, because otherwise that watch, all the pieces were there. The longer I shook it, the more disorderly it became. The more they got bent and chipped, the less of an opportunity they were ever going to work together. Or the same thing, a tornado blowing through a lumberyard is not going to build a house. And the universe is more complex than the watch and the lumberyard. And both of those would be ridiculous examples. But yet science would want you to believe that the universe, just a fork, boom, just blew it into. So that's a wrong answer. It was not a random, directionless force. But what was the cause? A personal agent, meaning someone with a will, someone with a person that they could make decisions and interact. They planned it and put it together. That makes sense. Do you understand this? That makes sense. What was the agent like? It was limited to the universe. Well, that would mean the universe is self-existent, meaning the one that created the universe itself built itself. Well, that's not right. That's an example. Worship the creation, and that people believe that. Here, God is found in things, in nature and animals. Many religions make it this far. Now, understand, many religions, if you're going to be an atheist, you're going to bail out of this a long time way up here at the beginning. It had no beginning, or the universe is self-caused or whatever. But if you're going to be religious, you will make it through. Was there a beginning? Yes. Was the universe caused? Yes. What was the cause? A personal agent of some sort. And then you get right here. What is this agent? Now you are defining God. You're this one right here. You're going to now identify him. And they're going to bail. This is what Paul says. When they refuse to recognize God, the theist, they're going to go and worship the creation itself. They're not going to make it past this. And they're going to end up worshiping, and many religions, like it says, make it this far, but they fail to see the true holy God. So, what is this agent like? Yes, it is separate from the universe. The creator would be intelligent, powerful, timeless, capable of choice, immaterial, and causeless. And now you got the last list right there. Idol religions are illogical. So things that Buddhism or Hinduism or ancient religions are all illogical. They're not thought out. Richard Dawson said there, Dawkins said, you know, faith is the great cop-out, the great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence, making fun of the Christians. No. The Christian's the only one that's going to make it through this. Or you have the Jews and the Islam is going to make it through this theistic list right here, because you're going to bail out. What is illogical, who is not thinking, is either one, the atheist, or two, some other religion that doesn't make it this far, and they're going to stop and worship the creation itself or think God is within the creation. Only one that's the only thinking groups out there are the theists. The three religions have a logical God. These three religions have a logical God: Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. But as we go through that, Christianity is the only true and complete revelation from God, Old Testament, New Testament. Islam, it's got its own faults because they get rid of the Trinity, which is necessary, and we've talked about that before. Okay, there is the example of the Kalam theory. Is that interesting? I mean, for me, every time I look at that, it's like it's simple. And all of a sudden, listen, when you look at that, all of a sudden you don't think, oh, I'm out here on a limb, I'm being ridiculous, and people are going to laugh at me. It's like, no, you're being logical. You are the only group that's actually being logical, answering questions, dealing with reality, the universe you live in, dealing with logic. Dawkins say, well, you're not thinking. Dawkins, you're not thinking. You're trying to force these things into your own perspective. We're actually embracing the evidence, saying, well, here we go. Science is on our side. It's going to continue to get on our side. It's going to continue to build. The only thing that's going to stop Christianity is going to be persecution. They're going to have to start killing Christians. They're going to have to eliminate the theist from the earth, because reality matches up. The power matches up. And again, that's where we're heading with this whole thing. Okay, I'll finish this, and then we'll pick up on page 6 next week with the teleology. Well, that was just the cosmological argument. Again, you can see that's, we've already talked about that, you know, danced around that. Thomas Aquinas took this one step further by addressing the need for a cause of the universe current existing. He says, think of music. When you hear music, it is existing, but when music stops being heard, it is because the source of the music has stopped. For something to exist, to be existing, something must be causing its current existence. Consider a human. The human is existing, but are they existing because it is the human's existence, or the human's essence to exist? No, the human is existing because, like music, something is the cause of the existence. Remove the cause, and the music or the human can no longer exist. Since you are the one who is existing, your existence is not caused by you existing, but by a cause whose very essence is existing. Now, all of a sudden, Jesus saying, I am, all these statements, I am the life. I mean, you are existing. Not only were you created by God, not only the Christian, the believer, but everything is continuing to exist because the piano is still being played. The piano is still there. The creator is still there, so you still have the music. Not only did he create music, the music's still playing because he's still there. He ceases to exist, we cease to exist because he is maintaining his creation. And that's not a choice that he's making. You know, hear me say this. It's not because God decided, okay, I'll let this continue to exist. It's because of his essence, his existence, that these things can continue to exist. If he, for some reason, would cease to exist, this whole thing would cease. We could not exist without him. Aquinas summary. All men know this to be God. After I just summed up his debate, and then he says, all men know this source of existence is God. Next week, we pick up the teleological argument. There's a few things here. I do want to point this out because this is kind of one of the highlights. Look at the very back page. The very last statement, number 3 on the back, page 14. What was God doing before he made the world? Augustine answered this question. First, he says, Augustine's first answer was, God was spending his time preparing hell for people who ask questions like this. This is Augustine, 400 A.D. Someone said, what was God doing before he was busy making hell for people that ask questions like that? Now, that sounds like a late-night show with Jim Kimmel or somebody. That's Augustine. Gotta love that guy. But he also said, God created time when he created the universe, so there was no time. So he has not always been existing. He's always existed. I mean, it's not like time, because he started time, so there's no measuring it, is what he's saying. Before creation of time, there was no eternity, which does not include passing moments. Passing moments are measurable time, which was created with the universe, so there was no way to measure God's eternal existing. He was just, I am. He was just the existing one. I'll pray, and then we're done. Father, we do thank you again for the chance to look into these things. We ask that we would ponder them. We'd ask that the Spirit would bring them to our understanding and enlighten us, that we'd be able to perceive the universe through your eyes and what you've intended to show us. But Father, also we would have good quality, quick, precise answers and explanations for people that question the faith, that are searching for answers, and that we'd be able to, in our own ability, to defend the faith that you've revealed to us. Again, we thank you for this opportunity. In Jesus' name, amen. Thank you for taking time.